Physics World.
Hello and thanks for joining us for this episode of Physics World Weekly. I'm Mateen Durrani, and coming up today we'll be talking about a massive discovery in the world of astronomy, in which researchers have captured the first ever image of a black hole. To find out what that's all about, we'll be joined by Physics World's news editor, Michael Banks, who's written a new story about the work. And we'll also hear from Tushna Commissariat, who's written extensively for Physics World about the Event Horizon Telescope, which was the network of telescopes that spotted the black hole. Later on, we'll talk to Anna Deming about an event at King's College London that saw art students and PhD students come together to discuss light and metrology. And as always, we'll bring you a roundup of some of the research highlights from the Physics World website. First up, though, it's time to talk about those first ever images of a black hole. And I'm joined by Michael Banks and Tushna Commissariat from the Physics World team.
Hello.
Right, so black holes, they're meant to be black. How on earth did we see this one? Michael, do you want to tell us about what black hole we've seen and where is it?
Well, black holes are some of the most extreme objects in the universe. They're kind of like a manifestation of Einstein's theory of general relativity, in which kind of quite a compact object could collapse and kind of create a black hole. So this black hole that you're seeing, that the first images have been released, that's from the M87 galaxy, which is in the Virgo cluster. And that's the black hole there is at the center of the M87, so it's called M87 star. So that's kind of what you're seeing, the black hole from this galaxy.
So how did we image it, Tushna? You know, to describe the picture that has been released of this black hole, what are we looking at?
It's a beautiful picture. At first glance, it might look like a bit of a fuzzy glowing orb. And you might be thinking, really, that's it? That's the black hole? It's a bit blurry, isn't it? But you've got to know that it's 55 million light years away at the heart of another galaxy. And if you happen to have watched the most excellent sci-fi film, Interstellar, and you saw the beautiful, obviously simulated black hole that they had in there, it's not too far off from that, actually. If you remember that film, there was, you know, big sort of circular, dark heart, but then there was this giant loop of glowing material, especially towards the lower half, like a sort of, Michael's been calling it the smiley face, hasn't he?
Yeah, smiley emoji.
Yes, the smiley emoji. It's almost like that. And that glowing matter that you see is all of the light and gas and dust that's trapped around the black hole. It's going to fall in. It's inevitable. That matter is never going to escape. It's trapped in the black hole's gravitational force, but quite like a plug hole, not everything falls in all in one go. It sort of whirls around and round the black hole for ages, trapped in these, that, you know, they call them relativistic loops, and some of the light there, it goes through, it's moving at almost, you know, light speeds, and it loops back and it gets really, really, really hot, and that's what the Event Horizon Telescope looks out for. That's what it spots, and that's exactly what we've seen now. And it's on a time, it moves, and they've seen that movement, but it's on the time scale of a couple of days. Right. So they observed it for about 4 days, was it, Michael?
Yeah, it's 4 days, on the 5th, 6th, 10th and 11th of April. That was 2017, so that's actually 2 years ago, was when they kind of caught those images. But of course it's taken a couple of years to kind of crunch through all the data that they use, kind of like quite powerful supercomputers to do that.
Right, so the Event Horizon Telescope is not one telescope, is it? It's a kind of network, isn't it? Michael, do you want to explain what that's all about?
Yes, this is a network of 8 telescopes that was involved in this latest study. So the thing is, with a single dish, when you're trying to resolve some of these objects, if you use a single dish, then that resolution is kind of proportional to the size of the dish. So of course then the bigger the better. But to kind of see the black hole or near the black hole event horizon, you would actually need if it was a single dish, that would have to be the size of the Earth.
That's crazy big, so.
Which is clearly impractical to have. So instead, what astronomers instead do is then combine the signals from multiple dishes.
Right.
So these dishes are all over the world. There's one in Spain, there's one in the South Pole, there's a few in the US. And they kind of cleverly combine the signals, kind of again crunch them through a supercomputer, and then this kind of then results in having a resolution that is comparable to kind of the size of the event horizon and what Tushner was describing earlier.
So this is pretty exciting event in astronomy. But Tushner, we were talking before about why did the astronomers not look at the supermassive black hole at the heart of our galaxy? Why did they go for this other one? What was the thinking behind that?
Yeah, so that was one of the things that surprised me, because I mean they had two targets. So it was Sagittarius A star, which is the black hole at the heart of our supermassive black hole at the heart of our galaxy, and then there's the M87 star, the one that we have seen now. And I think everyone thought that it would be Sagittarius A star that we would see first, because it's closer, it's our own galaxy, rather than a galaxy that's that much further away. So it was a surprise, yes, and that was one of my first questions. Oh, why M87 first? And so if you compare the two black holes, M87 is a much bigger galaxy. It's one of those super galaxies. Almost concurrently, the black hole is that much bigger. So it's almost three times bigger than the one in Sagittarius, the one in our galaxy, actually. But then it almost cancels out, because it's almost that much further away from us. So again, it was like, why did they do this? So as it turns out, what we were talking about earlier, the sort of the movement, that dynamical movement that happens right at the event horizon that they wanted to observe, what they found was that in Sagittarius A star, that movement was on the order of a timescale of minutes. So they would have to resolve this movement and on the order of timescale of minutes. And this is the first test. This is the first real observation. And the telescope just can't resolve at the order of minutes just yet. But with M87, this movement is on the order of days, which is why, as Michael described, the observations were over a period of 4 days. And if you look at all the pictures in the paper, you can see, you can actually see movement. You can see sort of in the first picture, it looks quite even, but in one of the second pictures, it looks like there's a bit more on one side rather than the other. So you can actually track, you know. And what's amazing is that, as just like LIGO, we've seen it improve so vastly since its first amazing observation. They've already, you know, increased by huge amounts the distance to which they can make observations. It'll be like that with the Event Horizon Telescope. This is just the first of many exciting images to come. They're gonna get to the point where they will image on a time scale of minutes, but that's gonna take time, that's gonna take more refinement, and so for now, it just made sense for them to go for M87. There was also the issue of, you know, the paper mentions the interstellar medium, and that causes lots of, so that's sort of all the stuff that lies between Earth and whatever you're observing across the galaxy, the solar system, across the universe, really. The interstellar medium is all the stuff between two solar systems within a galaxy, between two galaxies. That's the interstellar medium, you know. And so there's a lot of scattering and sort of, you lose light and you lose signal as you go through the interstellar medium. And that was also an issue when it came to imaging Sagittarius A star. So M87 was the lucky first.
Yeah. Michael, what else do we know about this black hole? There's some numbers that we've got out about it, aren't there?
And that's right, yeah. So by looking at what Tushy described earlier, kind of how the light kind of moves around the black hole. So when you compare this to simulations, you can deduce the size of the black hole. So what we had before was kind of estimates of its mass, and that was kind of between around 3.5 to 7.5 billion solar masses. It's kind
right,
of that's,
right.
That's the mass of the sun. So by looking at these simulations and comparing it with data, they have estimated the black hole to be 6.5 billion solar masses. So we kind of got but the error bar there is about 0.7 billion solar masses.
Right,
so
good old-fashioned error bar on it. Yeah.
That's right. So we've got a bit of a better estimate of the mass of the black hole. And they've also, I think from the data, they've also kind of estimated the distance as well from Earth, and a few other parameters then about its spin. So this is, the black hole is kind of what's known as a Kerr black hole, as worked out by general relativity. So that's kind of a spinning black hole. So there's kind of a few parameters there they've worked out. But I guess this finding is really all, as Tushy described earlier, it's really all about this kind of first image.
Right. So it's been a bit of a massive deal in astronomy, Tushy, hasn't it? I mean, how big an impact do you think it will have on the course of research in this field?
Well, I remember talking to Shep Dolman, who is the head of the Event Horizon Telescope, 5 years ago now, and he said that this you know, even just about one generation ago, if you told astronomers that you wanted to do this, it would have been thought completely impossible, genuinely, because it's a black hole by the very nature of it. But it's because this amazing technique that they use, which is very long baseline interferometry, where you link up lots of different radio telescopes, it's such an absolute leap in experimentation and measurement that it's amazing. And I mean, almost on the face of it, you think of it, you're like, oh, okay, we've got all these radio telescopes, sure, let's just link them all up. But then you're thinking, how do you do that? How do you get data at 7-8 different telescopes over the course of an entire night, but then build up one image using that data? So they had to go all over the world for years installing their very accurate atomic clocks, for example, across each site, so that each bit of information that they measured over the course of the night was perfectly timestamped. And so, again, like Michael pointed out, these images were sort of taken, the data was taken in 2017. And here we are, and it's April 2017 was when they looked at it. Mm. And here we are, and it's April 2019. So what were they doing for 2 years? They were building up this image. They were using every little bit of tag data from a site in Chile and marking it across the site in Mexico to the site in the South Pole and building up this image. It's an absolute feat of sort of technology. That's what it is. And again, I remember Shep explaining to me that the way you have to think of it is almost that each little point, each telescope is an antenna. That's how they refer to it, an antenna in this bigger scope. And so each antenna is like one little silver dot on the face of your telescope. And over the course of the night, as the Earth spins, that silver dot streams out into a line. And so you've filled out enough of the face of your telescope with a mirror. That's almost how you think of it, to think of how radio VLBI technology works. And that's how you have a telescope that's comparable to the size of the Earth. And the sort of the line that they love using is, it's, you know, can resolve an orange on the surface of the moon.
Right, so. Amazing, yeah.
I mean, what this also does, I guess, is it takes the event horizon itself, you know, which was before was kind of like a theoretical construct, and now it's kind of, you know, this image, and this has kind of made it real now, something that can be actually studied. Mm. I think that's kind of the real breakthrough with this, is taking it from theory to experimental.
Wow, so amazing stuff. So, Michael, if listeners want to find out more about this discovery, where can they look? You've written a new story, haven't you? What's the title? Where is it?
So the title of the new story is "The First Images of a Black Hole Unveiled by Astronomers in Landmark Discovery." So that's, you can read all about it on physicsworld.com.
Cool little video that people can go and look at as well on the website. So thanks, Michael. Thanks, Tushna. It's not every day we get a finding as exciting as this one. So thanks for joining us and telling everyone about the first ever image of a black hole. So that was black holes, and now we're joined by Anna Deming about an event at King's College London that saw art students and PhD physics students come together to discuss light and metrology.
Hello, I'm Anna Deming from Physics World, and I've been visiting students at King's College London, where art students and physics PhD students are at a workshop in the lead up to Late Light, an event where science meets art to celebrate the International Day of Light and the International Day of Metrology. Like any interdisciplinary enterprise, communicating ideas can be tricky but critical for the project's success. I've been getting involved with a workshop to get some tips together for communicating specialist ideas to a non-specialist audience. Here's some students talking about their projects and their take on the upcoming Late Light event. So I'm at King's College London, where I've been talking to researchers working both artists working with art and people working in the physics department at King's with respect to a project for Late Light, celebrating the International Day of Light coming up in May. So you could introduce yourself, tell us who you are and what is your particular project at the moment.
Okay, hello, my name is Yaprak Göker. I'm an information experience design student at the Royal College of Art, and my pathway is focused on sound design. And we're now working on a project that is based on a interactive light installation. And it's basically asking the question of how we can break the rigid rhythm of machines and make it more human.
Right, and that sounds a fascinating topic. What made you decide to work on that topic?
That's a great question. Well, we're becoming more and more automatic, robotic, rigid, and we're starting to lose our own rhythms, inner rhythms, what makes us human in this 21st century with all these information overload with the current technology and everything. So we're trying to take audience's attention to that topic and raise the awareness.
Great. Well, it'd be wonderful to have a chance to see the final piece on May the 20th at the event. And could you also introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your work?
Yes, of course. Hello, my name is Marciano. I'm a first year physics PhD student at King's College London. I'm now working on a microchip for sensing applications, and basically what I will try to do is I will detect solutions, particles I mean, in a solution, and different types of particles, of course, which might be helpful to increase the sensitivity in detecting diseases or explosives. And yeah, basically that.
And how does it improve the sensitivity?
Basically what we are trying to do is we are trying to agglomerate very little amounts of particles, so increase the concentration a lot by trapping them with a laser on a specific spot. And that way the particles will be trapped in that spot and you can perform the sensing in those areas.
Right. And I'm also joined by, could you tell me who you are and what your current project is?
Hello, my name is Miao Zhao, and I'm also a first year PhD student in King's College London. And my project is used nanomaterials for photodynamic therapy, especially used to cure cancers. And as we all know, that the traditional therapy for cancer is chemotherapy and radiotherapy. But that it can have many side effects, like it will damage our immune system and the drug resistance and so on. But if we use the photodynamic therapy, we can overcome that problems. That is my project.
And finally, I know this. I've had the pleasure of talking to Steve Poe earlier, who was lumbered with me as a partner in one of the exercises for this writing for non-specialist workshop, and managed to make my job sound interesting. So thank you very much, Steve. Could you tell us a little bit about your work?
Yes, so thank you for that kind introduction. So I'm also a first year PhD student at King's College London. The research that I'm conducting right now here at King's is essentially to improve the efficiency of hydrogen generation from water splitting, using essentially nothing more than sunlight and nanotechnology. Nanotechnology more specifically being quantum dots, so semiconducting nanomaterials, you know, 1,000 times smaller than the width of the human hair, and metallic nanoparticles as well. And essentially improving on the efficiency from current technologies that we have today, and essentially reducing cost, reducing size, and hopefully increasing hydrogen yields, essentially.
Great. So a new approach for cleaner energy. And today we had a wonderful exercise where we had to explain each other's work. And we got to hear about a lot of physics projects and a lot of art projects. Are you familiar? Do you go to a lot of art exhibitions, or was it new to be hearing about the process of people's artwork in this way today?
So I mean, obviously, I enjoy going to art galleries and museums. However, it's not very often that I think about the link between science and art. So coming to an event and a workshop like this that talks about combining the two fields together to create some sort of art installation, it's interesting, and it's never really something that I thought about and considered. So it's nice to see that there's a way of being able to bridge those two together and also talk about it in a way that is interesting and engaging to essentially everyone.
Mm. And it was quite striking hearing people describing their projects, how natural it is to talk about these art projects in the context of science and vice versa. I'm going to come back to you just at the end, because I know that you are preparing you're deeply committed actually already to preparing a piece for the International Day of Light on the 28th of May. Could you say in a nutshell what attracted you to get involved with the project, with working with scientists, and why people might want to come to the event?
To be honest, physics is a fundamental science, right? It's everywhere in our daily lives. And in Royal College of Art, we're forced to think widely around art. And especially one of our instructors has a background on quantum physics. And every week we have seminars based on how we can approach art and different perspectives, and that requires physics as well. So it's about light, it's about physics, the late light, sorry, it's going to be amazing. And I thought to get a different perspective of what I'm doing would be a great chance. That's why I'm here. And that's why people should come and see how art is everywhere, how science is everywhere, and it all makes sense in the end.
Yeah, great. Look at things from a fresh perspective and understand it in a new way. Wonderful. Well, we'll all be really excited to come to the event on the 20th May.
So that was Anna Deming talking about an art-science mashup in London. And just before we end, here's Susan Curtis to tell us about some of the research highlights on Physics World this week. So Susan, I don't think these are going to eclipse the first images of a black hole that we discussed earlier, but what have you picked for us from the website?
Yeah, there's plenty of exciting things as well, Martin. So first up is the latest advance from the Explorer Consortium, which is building the world's first total body PET scanner. Now, this new machine is around 40 times more sensitive than current clinical scanners and recently produced its first human images. And as part of the project, the team has developed two smaller scale PET scanners called the Mini Explorers. Now, these are fully functional scanners for testing the components used in the human scale device, but also functions as a high resolution, high sensitivity platform for clinical veterinary applications. And the researchers have now performed the first in vivo imaging of a canine patient, as we report in the article, Whole Body PET for Your Pet.
Canine, is that a dog?
Exactly, a dog being imaged inside a PET scanner, yes.
Sounds, so, there's a dog joke in there somewhere, but so what's next, Susan?
Yeah, well, this week, a couple of the editors from Physics World are at the meeting of the European Geophysical Union, which is taking place in Vienna. And in one report from the meeting, James Dacey highlights a European project that's developing robotic systems to search for rare earth elements in a bunch of abandoned mines across Europe. So Luis Lopez of La Palma Research Center in Spain explained in his talk that Europe's industrial heritage has left behind a vast network of these mines, approximately 30,000 of them. And most of them have been closed, not really because all of the minerals have been taken away, but because of various economic factors. So as the years have passed, most of these mines have become flooded, and that makes it really dangerous and expensive to see whether they could be reopened and mined for these valuable elements. And James explains in his article, which is called Swimming Robots Help Europe Rediscover Its Mining Mojo, how the UNEXMIN project is developing waterproof robots to explore and map these mines.
Wow, waterproof robots, that sounds swimmingly good. And I'm going to not do any more jokes, so final story from the website, Susan.
So yes, not last but not least, we've got a laser with a polarisation that can be made to oscillate at more than 200 gigahertz, which has been created by researchers in Germany and the US. And the researchers say that the device could be used to boost the data capacity of the server farms that are used in optical communications networks, although they do caution that there's still quite a lot more work to do before practical devices could be made. So what they talk about are the millions of tiny connections that exist inside a data center, and each of them use intensity modulated lasers. At the moment, the speed at which a data stream can be pushed through the connection depends on how quickly the laser can switch between their intensity corresponding to a 1 and the intensity that corresponds to a 0, and that's currently around 35 gigahertz. Researchers have therefore been exploring ways to modulate other properties of the light, and in this study, the research team designed a new spin laser based on the birefringence of the laser's gain medium. And you can find out a lot more about that story and also about the challenges that remain in an article called Ultrafast Spin Laser Could Boost Optical Data Transmission.
That's brilliant, Susan. And thanks to you for joining us. Don't forget, if you like what you hear today, you can subscribe to this podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. And also, we're now on Spotify. See you next week.
Physics World.